That's the last information I've been able to get about this rather shadowy character. Margaret Rowan and her husband had at least 4 children. She had a daughter who was born about 1901. And then there were 3 sons. There was John Rowan, who was born about 1901. There was Alfred Rowan, who was born 3 years later, about 1904. And both of them continued living in the Los Angeles area. In fact, one of them in Pasadena. And then the third son was named Ward. He was born about 1907 and lived in Yucaipa. And I would be very interested to know if any of those people are still alive today. And if they were, if they would be willing to talk. Now we go to the printed outline and the introduction there. Incidentally, there are several unfortunate typographical errors. I typed this myself. I can't lay this on my secretary. She doesn't type like this. In 1908, Sir Walter Scott wrote in Marmion these lines, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave," O-H, and tangled is T-A-N-G-L-E-D, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." She epitomized, Margaret Rowan epitomized these lines very well. She was guilty successively of falsehoods, theft, forgery, false predictions, attempted murder, and later adultery, and served 1 year in San Quentin prison. Dr. Olson, when I took you a week ago Friday to the San Francisco airport at 8 o'clock in the morning, I told you what I was going to do. I told him that I was going to go to San Quentin prison on my way back to Angwin, which I did, only to find out that the records are no longer at the prison. They're up in Sacramento, Department of Corrections, California State Department of Corrections. So I've got to write to them. I wanted to find out about her record in prison. She spent 1 year in San Quentin prison. Incidentally, that was in 1927, and it was very shortly after that, I think not later than 1929, that female prisoners, I did discover this, that female prisoners were no longer housed in San Quentin. So within a year or two of her being there, with another woman and another man, a Mary Wade and a Dr. Bowser, who were 2 of her disciples, who tried to murder Dr. Fulmer, we'll come to that story, and all 3 of them went to San Quentin. She claimed to get her first vision June 22, 1916. There were hearings by church leaders and committees of investigation who reported that they found her writings contained error and her writings were not from God. She formed an organization called the Reformed Seventh-day Adventist Church in Southern California. This is not to be confused with several other Reformed Seventh-day Adventist churches. And I don't know whether the one in Sacramento, California is a different organization from Denver. There are Reformed, in the United States, there is a Reformed church which has headquarters in Sacramento. There is another one which has headquarters in Denver. And they claim to be the true church. I don't know what they're going to do if their membership ever passes 143,999 and they get 144,000 members. But you see, one of the evidences that we aren't the true church, we already have more than 144,000 in our church. Incidentally, right here on this campus in January, 1 year ago, a former vice president of that Reformed church, one, either the Denver or the Sacramento, I think the Denver group, I can't recall his name at the moment. Helmut Kramer, thank you. Helmut Kramer, K-R-A-M-E-R. Helmut Kramer was a student of mine in my class, and he shared with me a document which he wrote to former members of the Reformed Seventh-day Adventist Church explaining why he left. He is now, I think, a pastor in the Rocky Mountain Conference. Yeah. See, Rocky Mountain takes up Colorado and Wyoming, and he is in that conference. He's a fine man, a jewel of a Christian. But that was not, his Reformed Church was not the one that Margaret Rowan founded. She was disfellowshipped from the Los Angeles SDA Southside Church November 15, 1919. And what follows are some examples of things that went on which were wrong and created all kinds of problems for the church. First of all, falsehood. She lied about her own parents. This was a very involved story. She claimed that her father, Alfred Wright, was her father, but the so-called mother, Matilda Wright, who actually was the woman who bore the child, was an adoptive mother. This is the story. Alfred Wright was in Philadelphia, and he had an affair with the daughter of a wealthy socialite, and the girl got pregnant. And so the family said to Alfred, okay, you conceived this baby, you got to get rid of him. And of course they were wealthy, so they could afford to keep the girl at home to have the baby. Now this is the story. It is not true, but this is the story. And so the girl had the baby at home, and after the baby was born, they swore the doctor to silence, and there was enough money to guarantee he'd keep his mouth shut. And then they called Alfred up, and the baby was in a little basket, and they said, you get rid of this thing. So Alfred, according to the story, went down to the wharf, the pier, in Philadelphia, and was about ready to drop it in the water, when suddenly he thought, well, you know, that isn't really the right thing to do. So he took it home and said to his wife, I found this foundling somewhere, and you suppose we could take it and adopt it? And that's how she claimed she had her beginnings. This irritated her mother no end. And it would you, lady, if you had carried a baby for 9 months and then it said it didn't come out of your body. Anyway, this was the story. Now, this was necessary because later on, in her visions, the Lord not only successively revealed to her the origins, but led her back to her real natural mother, who's now married in Philadelphia. And her maiden name was Mae Gillette, and now she is Mae Mills. And she goes back there, and the mother is so happy to meet her long-lost daughter that she plies her with money and all kinds of things. And, of course, the money was money that was coming out of tithes and offerings donated by people. Anyway, she claimed to get many gifts and money from this Mr. and Mrs. Mills. She kept repeatedly promising to produce them in Southern California to substantiate her claim, but she never really did. She tried to hire an actress to impersonate the mother, and for some reason the actress didn't go along with it. Maybe there wasn't enough money offered, or maybe the actress was afraid this thing could wind up in court. Ultimately, Margaret Rowan did wind up in court for another matter. Anyway, she finally got a friend of hers to wear a big hat with a big black veil and show up at a certain church where Margaret was preaching. Nobody was told about this ahead of time, and then later Margaret said, oh, you see that? You remember that lady that was sitting there? Well, that was my mother. Fortunately, the father, Mr. Mills, died, so she didn't have to produce him. But it was quite a story. All right, theft. Embezzlement is the legal word. She stole money from her own religious movement. She convinced a lot of people, and maybe at this point we ought to go to the blackboard and notice why those who followed her tended to believe. First of all, there was supernatural physical phenomena. She had supernatural visions. This was a major factor. And as I mentioned a few moments ago, there was a woman in Los Angeles who saw Ellen White in vision, a woman named Elizabeth J. Roberts. And Elizabeth Roberts was the daughter of a family that had many of the pioneers visit them. I think they lived up around Petaluma or Healdsburg, somewhere in that part of California. And Ellen White and her husband stayed in their home and so on. Anyway, Mrs. Roberts, as a girl, said, I saw Ellen White in vision. And this is the same thing. And then, of course, there was the testimony of Dr. Bert Fulmer, who in 1922 wrote out a report on the Southern California prayer bands. And he said that she's repeatedly had visions that we found very remarkable. They were supernatural. And her visions were witnessed by a large number of people. So the first of the three reasons why her followers tended to believe and follow her was the physical phenomena that was unquestionably supernatural. The second reason was the parentage story, which of course made Margaret an illegitimate child. And back in the 1920s, illegitimate children were in bad repute. People still don't know that there are no illegitimate children, there are only illegitimate parents. But anyway, one of the big arguments against trying to disprove that Margaret Rowan was a prophet was, why would she tell a story about herself that would make her to be an illegitimate child? I mean, nobody's going to do that, you know. So that was, you know, she wouldn't tell it if it weren't true. And of course, the Lord supernaturally revealed the identity and location of her real parents. The Lord supernaturally reunited Margaret with her real mother, and large sums of money received by Margaret from her real mother. And then there was a photo that came back with Margaret, in which it showed Margaret with an older woman who looked a lot like her. And what happened was, it was a composite photograph. Margaret dressed in such a way and fixed her hair in such a way to make herself look as young as possible, had a picture taken. Then she dressed herself and fixed her hair to make her look as old as possible, had another picture taken, and then the photographer put the two pictures together in a composite, and she came back from Pennsylvania and showed everybody this picture of her and her mother. Very fine. Then there was the third reason why people tended to believe. There was an affidavit of an alleged Dr. E.C. Kavanaugh of Spruce Street in Philadelphia. And they contacted Dr. Kavanaugh later on. You see, he reportedly witnessed her in vision in Philadelphia in October of 1917, October 8. And she was in vision either 2 hours and 8 minutes or 2 hours and 10 minutes, depending. I get both of those in my research. Anyway, approximately 2 hours and 10 minutes. And this Dr. Kavanaugh turned out to be a real Dr. Kavanaugh, but he said when they contacted him, church leaders from the General Conference contacted him, he said, I don't even know this Margaret Rowan. And he's the one who wrote a testimonial. You know, there's another parallel with Ellen White. Doctors writing testimonials saying, we've seen this lady in vision. Mrs. Rowan got a family by the name of Fulmer. Dr. Bert Fulmer and his wife to become followers. And finally, they lived in a duplex side by side on Gower Avenue in Hollywood, California. I would guess that the house probably still stands. The Fulmers lived in one side of the duplex and the Rowans lived in another. Dr. Fulmer, I think I incorrectly indicated, was her treasurer. Actually, the treasurer was Mrs. Fulmer. He acted as her publishing manager and, of course, helped his wife with the money. He was an Adventist physician practicing in Hollywood. Well, how did she steal money from her organization? Well, sometimes when she was traveling, she would receive money from people and assure them that Dr. Fulmer would send them a receipt. I don't know whether they needed it for tax purposes in those days, but just to... And she had receipt books printed up, but just to keep everything on the up and up and to avoid the appearance of evil. But some of those people would never get receipts, and they would write Dr. Fulmer and his wife and say, hey, my receipt for $2,000? My receipt for $1,500? Never got to me. Well, one time someone sent her about $1,100 or $1,200, and about $700 or $800 of it was to go to the General Conference on a pledge, and the rest of it was to be kept by her. And she wrote back and said, oh, I misunderstood. I sent the whole check to the General Conference. Well, they had no record of it, and they had no receipt for it. However, it had her signature endorsing the check on the other side, and it was deposited in her bank account. The lady had a hard time telling truth. Anyway, sometimes she would go shopping with her husband in the morning just about the time the mailman was due. And they would start down Gower Street, and here comes the mailman. Oh, good morning, Mrs. Rowan. He knew her. She got mail from all over the world. And she'd say, you know, I'm on my way shopping, but let me just take a look at the mail before you drop it off at the house. Remember, Fulmers are on the other side of the duplex, and she's on one side, and Fulmers are treasures. So she goes through it, and anything that looks like it's got a check in, she just lifts it out and then sends the mailman on with the rest of the mail. And when the mail is delivered, Fulmers don't know but what this is the whole mail. Later on, he discovered it and documented at least $10,000 that she took that way, and they had suspicions about another $7,000 or $8,000. So she stole from her own organization. Then there was forgery. In the autumn of 1919, Margaret Rowan claimed to have seen, in vision, a letter written by Ellen White, which was dated August 10, 1911. Now remember, that's a year before Margaret Rowan even became a Seventh-day Adventist, which indicated that Margaret Rowan was to be Ellen White's successor. The forged document was smuggled into the vault of the White estate at Elmshaven on November 11, 1919 by Dr. Fulmer. Willie White was not there. He hadn't come back from annual council in Washington. And an office girl opened up the vault when Dr. Fulmer and his party came. They said they'd like to see the vault. And, of course, the Whites at this point did not know what was going on. And so he managed to smuggle a document into the vault. Very curiously, when the secretary went to throw the switch, no electricity came on. And so she left the vault open. I mean, this could only happen one in a million times. She left the vault open and went to get a candle, and it took her 10 or 15 minutes. Now, there was a window right next to the vault door. And light was coming through that window, and it shone on the drawer 1911. Fulmer pulled the drawer out, stuffed in this false document, and shoved the drawer back in, and he did it so hastily that he got it in askew. He had to force it in, and it went in kind of on an angle. 4 or 5 weeks later, and incidentally, the vault, after they left, the vault was locked and was not reopened until Willie White came back. I think it was about 4 or 5 weeks later. And when he opened it and walked in, the very first thing he saw was this drawer in the manuscript file that was askew. And he said right out loud, somebody's been working on this that doesn't know this vault, doesn't know these files. And he pulled it out, and in the drawers, there are two wires, like a voucher file. And these wires were bent over, and it took him about 10 minutes to straighten them up again. So, anyway, he discovered that the wires were bent, and he didn't, at the time, discover this false document in there because it was buried under some of the other pages. So, anyway, after Fulmer came back to Hollywood and said, okay, I got the thing smuggled into the vault of the White Estate. You see, Margaret Rowan told him that apparently an angel had brought this to her. She said, it's not going to do me any good here. We've got to get that back in the vault. So Fulmer was a fool. He was suckered into this thing. So anyway, on December 17, 1919, Willie White and his son Arthur, who was just a boy of about 12 or 13, 14, discovered this thing there. And your outline says that there were 8 evidences of its forged nature. Would you change 8 to 11? I'm going to give you 3 more. 8 evidences of its forged nature. Now, this is the first forgery. She forged this document 2 different times. The sheet was not perforated by the 2 hole, and that should be H-O-L-E, not H-O-L-D. The sheet was not perforated by a 2-hole pout of voucher punch, which was used on all authentic Ellen White documents in the White Estate Archives. Secondly, the sheet, when it was discovered, was not found on the file spindle as the other documents. It was just stuffed in. It had no holes, and it was not on the spindle. Third, it was written on different paper stock from that used in the White Estate. Fourth, the size of the paper was different from that of the White Estate documents. This sheet of paper was 13 inches long, whereas White Estate used 11-inch long paper. So it was a wrong-sized sheet. Fifth, it was typed with a black typewriter ribbon, whereas the White Estate at that time was using a purple indelible and blue ribbon. Wrong color typewriter ribbon. Six, it had a double line heading. The White Estate format was a single line heading. Seven, the typewriter was different from the typewriter, that is the type, was different from the typewriter used in the White Estate. Eight, now this is, these last two, in fact, I'm giving you three things now, and you can put them down as G, H, and I, and then when we get over to the other page, you can re-letter those. So for G, the typewriter was different from the one the White Estate was using. H, it contained no document codes, that is a file number and so on for reference purposes. Every Ellen White letter in our file has a document code on it. And I, Ellen White was not even in Sanitarium, California on August 11 or August 10. 2 days earlier, she went to Long Beach to attend a camp meeting. And on August 10, that's when the forgery was dated, she wasn't even in town. She was down in Long Beach. Now if you'll turn to page 107, you can re-letter G and H to be J and K. The new J, former G, it was dateline St. Helena, California. The White Estate used Sanitarium, California. And the last one, K, the signature was demonstrably a forgery. And the big giveaway immediately was the way the letter G in Ellen G. White was written. And I have here a copy of that original document, and there are no holes at the top. No holes at the top, and the forgery at the bottom, the signature is very demonstrably a forgery. I don't have time to tell you the ins and outs where another document was forged. I have a copy of that here. This time they managed to get the holes punched and then torn, and the story was that this was torn out, but it's still dated St. Helena, California instead of Sanitarium, California, but it has an authentic Ellen White signature. And what they did, they took a copy of Life Sketches that had the signature of Ellen White under a photograph, and they had a rubber stamp made of the signature, and then they used that, so then they had an authentic signature. She was quite a lady. All right, we're on page 107, Roman numeral number 4, false predictions. Margaret Rowan announced in November 1923 that the close of probation was 3 months away. It would take place on February 6, 1924. Then, the second coming of Christ would take place on February 6, 1925. Incidentally, there are a lot of people today who think that the close of probation will take place 1 year before Jesus comes. Do you know why they think that? What in the Bible would lead somebody to believe that there would be 1 year between the close of probation and the second coming? Okay. All of her plagues will fall in one day, Revelation. There's only one problem with that. There's another place that says her plagues will come in an hour. So, you see, what I think the Bible is trying to tell us in Revelation is that the duration of those plagues is a brief but indeterminate period. Anyway, there are a lot of Adventists today who think it's going to be a year after the close of probation before the Lord comes. Ellen White says in great controversy that some of those seven last plagues are going to fall simultaneously. The last movements will be rapid ones. Anyway, she announced the close of probation for February 6, 1924, and the second coming of Christ would take place on February 6, 1925. Now, about 3 weeks before the second coming was scheduled, she declared that she was shown in vision that the 144,000, if necessary, would be taken from their abiding places by the angels and transported to the gathering place, from which they would be immediately taken to heaven on February 6, 1925. The prediction created a great sensation. Media coverage was heavy in Southern California and across the nation. And when I was teaching at Pacific Union College and I first learned about Margaret Rowan, I was visiting with an elderly Adventist lady who lived in a mobile home park in Yountville, which is 20 miles maybe from the campus. And she had a scrapbook with newspaper clippings that she had clipped out of Los Angeles newspapers and San Francisco newspapers about Margaret Rowan. And I asked her if I could borrow it, and I Xeroxed those. And, of course, when I joined the White Estate, I discovered that the White Estate has a lot of newspaper clippings and other materials, documentary materials, but she created no small stir in the public press. The media generally tended to identify Rowan's cult with the SDA Church, much to the discomfiture of the president of the General Conference, A.G. Daniels, and others. And they made strenuous efforts to disassociate themselves from her group. In the wake of the non-coming of Jesus, Margaret Rowan disappeared for a while and then came to life. Now, when Jesus didn't come on February 6, 1925, a lot of her followers began to realize that something was wrong. Although she said that the Lord came to her and told her that he was on the way. He had left heaven, but he was detouring around the universe and he hadn't quite gotten to the earth yet. Furthermore, she told them that one of the signs would be that she was going to be translated. I suppose she was planning to disappear and that would constitute translation. She never was translated, however. Anyway, a lot of her followers began to get their eyes open when the cumulative evidence, and then when Fulmer starts getting all these letters, I didn't get my receipt for the $2,000 I gave Sister Rowan. I didn't get my receipt for the $1,500, for the $500. Incidentally, by this time, Margaret Rowan's garage had 8 automobiles in it, including several Cadillacs. That, by the way, was the day when you could buy a Cadillac for $800. I don't think those times will ever return again. That's a new Cadillac for $800. And she had 8 cars in her garage. She traveled in style. Well, when Benjamin Fulmer realized that the woman was guilty of embezzlement and lies and forgery and all the rest of it, he went to the Pacific Union Conference officers and he made a clean confession. He said, "I am the one who put that forged document in the vault of the White Estate." And that was the last piece of the puzzle they hadn't been able to figure out. They knew the thing was a forgery, but they couldn't figure out how it got in there. And so Fulmer told. Well, of course, they were not slow in passing this word on to the church. And of course, when Margaret Rowan saw this coming out in the Review and Herald, her rage knew no limits. You know what they say about a woman scorned? It's apparently true. So she got 2 of her disciples, a Dr. Bowser and his nurse, Mary Wade. By the way, Dr. Bowser's wife divorced Dr. Bowser on the grounds of adultery with Mary Wade. And the former Mrs. Bowser, before the second coming, went into Los Angeles court to get an injunction against the doctor from selling all his property and giving it to Margaret Rowan because she was afraid she wouldn't get her alimony. So there's interesting sidelights here. Anyway, Dr. Bowser and Mary Wade and Margaret Rowan went to a motel on Lancashire Boulevard. And on the night of February 27, 1927, they telephoned Dr. Fulmer in Hollywood on Gower Street. And they said, the man who telephoned, he said, "Are you Dr. Fulmer?" "Yes." "Well," he said, "I am here as a tourist." He says, "My name is J.J. Ellison. I live in Bridgeville, California, and I am ill, and I don't know any doctors here, and I went to the Yellow Pages and looked up physicians, and I found your name, and I called you. Would you come? Well, sure. It's after midnight. So he got his little black bag and got in his car and drove over there, and there was one motel cabin, number 11, which had the lights on. All the rest of them were unlit, so he had no trouble finding the right cabin. He knocked on the door. Somebody said, come in. He opened the door, and in front of him was a man who was leaning over a bed with his back toward him. And when he walked in the door, that man straightened up, turned around. He recognized it was Bowser, and Bowser had a big lead pipe and hit him over the head. Didn't knock him completely out, but dazed him. And he sort of fell to the floor and started scuffling. Mary Wade had a syringe, hypodermic syringe, with poison in it. And she tried to get it into his arm. The needle broke off in the arm, the only thing that saved the man's life. And he was scuffling around. And, of course, you know, when you think you're in danger of death, or adrenaline starts coming in and gives you lots of strength. And they were wrestling around, and he was crying out. And the people in the adjoining motel cabin thought it was a bunch of drunks. And they called the police and said, would you come and arrest these people so we can get some sleep? And the police arrived just in time to save Dr. Fulmer's life. In the motel cabin, they found, in addition to the hypodermic syringe with its broken needle and the lead pipe, they found a length of rope, and they found a burlap bag and a piece of canvas and a few other things, a blanket, and a long-handled spade. They were going to get rid of the body out in the desert. Dr. Fulmer was subsequently treated for his injuries by Dr. L.S. Wellborn. Margaret Rowan had managed to slip out of the cabin by the time the police got there, but they picked her up the next day. Mary Wade had managed to slip out. Bowser was still in the room, but within a short time, they had all three of them arrested. And Bowser was a Battle Creek naturopath, general practice in medicine, 15 years, Los Angeles, follower of Margaret Rowan. And so the three went to trial, first in Los Angeles Municipal Court on March 11, 1927, before Judge Charles B. McCoy, Deputy District Attorney W.B. Heinecke, prosecuted. And Fulmer persuaded them to reduce the charge from attempted murder to assault with a deadly weapon with intent to do great bodily injury, because he wanted to reduce the term of imprisonment. This was not altruism. He wanted to finish his research on the embezzlement, and when Margaret Rowan would be let out of jail, he wanted to meet her at the gate of the jail with a policeman and rearrest her for embezzlement, and this time send her up for a good long time. He very graciously agreed to reduce the charge. The three defendants pleaded guilty. The case was subsequently transferred to L.A. Superior Court, Department 21, on July 28, 1927, before the Honorable Judge Fletcher Bowron, who later, in 1948, when I began my ministry there, was the mayor of Los Angeles. At this time, Margaret Rowan was about 46 years old, and her sons John, 26, Alfred, 23, and Ward, 20, were living in the greater Los Angeles area. The three were allowed to plead guilty to a reduced charge. They were sentenced from 1 to 10 years, with a recommended term of 5 years after probation was denied. Mary Wade was admitted to San Quentin Prison on August 10, 1927, and Margaret Rowan, prisoner 43969, followed the next day. She was released after serving 1 year. She was placed on parole, which she promptly jumped and disappeared. Aftermath. Fulmer died of a heart attack in Hollywood on April 3, 1928, while she was still in prison, less than 8 months after she entered San Quentin. He therefore was never able to prosecute her for fraud, grand theft, etc., for which he spent his final days gathering evidence. Margaret Rowan was released from San Quentin after about a year, disappeared, but later surfaced in Florida. In 1931, she was traveling with a man named J.J. Hartman in Florida, staying in motels as Hartman's wife and holding meetings among some Adventists. And a motel operator signed a sworn affidavit reporting the facts, copies of which were circulated in cities where Rowan was trying to raise sympathy and cash for her cause and doing quite a bit of damage to her credibility. She is believed to have died in the late 1940s. Now we go to the board, and I give you the reasons why those who left her finally left, why they tended to disbelieve. First of all, was the failure of her predictions. She predicted the second coming of Christ on February 6, 1925, and she also failed to be translated as she was predicting. Then, of course, inconsistency with former revelation. Her teachings were not in harmony with Scripture or Ellen White. She told her followers to store up food for the time of trouble and the famine that was coming. But in early writings, 56 to 58, Ellen White specifically said, don't store up food. She said that Pilate and his followers were wandering the earth alive with Satan during the millennium. And boy, what a story she concocted there. The Bible teaches that all the wicked will be dead during the millennium. She said that Christ was one of seven archangels and that he was elevated to sonship subsequently. Well, that is not true either. Then there was negative fruitage. Her followers continued missionary work after the close of probation, February 6, 1924, never fully explaining why. I mean, if probation's closed, why do any missionary work? Also, there were the forgeries. There were two Ellen White letters that were forged, and we didn't talk about Elsie Miller's confession letter and the letter of confession forgery of Willie White. We didn't have time, but these were all forgeries. The photo of Margaret Rowan and Mae Gillette was a forgery. The testimony of Dr. Kavanaugh was a forgery. And incidentally, Margaret Rowan had a testimony from Paul, the spirit of Paul, but she didn't indicate where Paul was when he gave it. Then there were the deceptions, the foundling story, the real estate claims to property ownership, the fake story of Margaret Rowan's death and subsequent resurrection. She claimed to have died and was resurrected. And there were some people who believed it. They never produced a death certificate, however. There was the fake vision on the apricot seed. One time, Margaret Rowan was at the table with her husband and F.I. Richardson and his wife. Richardson was an ex-Adventist minister who was disfellowshipped, who was very active in promoting her thing. And he mentioned at the table, he said, you know, he said, I read in the newspaper or heard on the radio that there are scientists now that are using apricot seeds and they are extracting oil from them. And Margaret Rowan corrected him, said, no, I saw it in vision and they're working from the skins of apricots, not the seeds. And Richardson didn't think he was wrong, and so he went down. Apparently this project, the scientific research, was being done in the Los Angeles area, and he went in and he said, where are all the seeds? Where's all the skin? Because Margaret Rowan said in vision it was the skin. They said, oh, we're not extracting the oil from the skin, we're extracting it from the seeds. And he said, well, I thought so. But yet Margaret Rowan at the table said she had a vision that they were extracting it from the skin. Well, there were lies about Willie White removing and destroying the authentic Ellen White letter in the file. There was the impersonation of Mrs. Mills, and so on. Then, fourth, there was the embezzlement from her own organization. And fifth, there was the attempted murder of Dr. Fulmer. So, we have the incredible story of Margaret Rowan and an interesting example of what Sir Walter Scott meant when he wrote, oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive.
This concludes another lecture from the 1986 E.G. White Estate Prophetic Guidance Seminar held at Andrews University. As a service to the church and in cooperation with E.G. White Estate, this has been a special American Cassette Ministries production. International copyright, 1986, all rights reserved.
To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. Peace. coming soon.